Everybody was a good boss.
Hi.
And women. I remember Majora. I remember Majora.
I think it was that long, you know, the
sometimes
lunch
we were, time we had
between
eight
lunch and between four sessions.
Right.
And you want to
oh, yeah.
A lot of them have committed.
You don't really have
nice.
To.
So
would we? Yes.
You could be my first
one. You know,
try to keep the majority Republicans here. I mean, it was just terrible.
Yeah.
Times we had eight to nine.
I think Barr is telling them that they had leftover pizza night every half the seven times I was selling four.
There you go.
I bought a pizza.
Okay.
Yeah.
Transportation and Regional Governance Committee meeting of March 28th is called to order.
That's the only one.
And let's see. I wonder if Representative Petersburg, would you care to move the minutes, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would love to move the minutes of March 26th.
March 26th. All right. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the minutes of March 26th are approved. And we're going to skip here to House File 3789, Representative Zerwas, and your bill. We'll move that, and it is, you have an author's amendment, I see. So it looks very technical, so we'll just move that amendment, the A180721. Everyone had a chance to find that. All in favor of the author's amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. All right, Representative Zerwas, tell us about your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The amendment that you just adopted fixes a technical correction in the bill. And I had the word yellow added a few lines too low, and so the technical amendment brings that back. Up on line 1.8, just before the second period. This has to do with new buses that are being shipped to Minnesota bus companies today. In current state law, the rub rails, the bottom rail of a school bus, in state law, is set to be black. In the new set of buses that were shipped out this year, a batch of them have the rub rails painted yellow. The State Patrol has not been enforcing this, but we wanted to make the technical corrections so that the current bus companies with the newest version of school buses aren't violating state law as it's written. I've had no known opposition to this bill.
All right. Any wonder? Other folks wanting to discuss the bill? Anyone from the audience? All right. Seeing none, then I'll renew my motion to re-refer House File 3789 to Transportation Finance as amended. House File 3789 as amended. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank
you, Representative. All right. All right. We can take Representative Poston, and that bill is 4174. Welcome, Representative Poston, and I'll move your bill, House File 4174, and that is going on to Transportation Finance. So go ahead and tell us about your bill, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Committee. House File 4174. Designates a stretch of Trunk Highway 210 in Cass County as a memorial to State Trooper Ray Krueger. Ray Krueger's family was going to be here to testify with me today, but unfortunately it's a seven-hour round trip and they were here just a day ago testifying with the Senate. I'll tell you a little bit about the trooper. He started his trooper career in 1934. And he died in an automobile accident while on duty in 1959 on that stretch of Highway 210. The memorial would be at no cost to the state of Minnesota, as the memorial signs will be put up by a couple of law enforcement entities, nonprofits that do this sort of thing. His children, who I talked to earlier today, his grandchildren actually wanted me to mention a few things about him. He has 12 grandchildren, 20 great-grandchildren, and 7 great-great-grandchildren, with another one on the way. And most of them were here to talk to the Senate the other day. They had quite a group of them over there. There's also a legacy that he's very proud of law enforcement in the family. One of his sons is an Army MP. He has a grandson that is a police officer, and he has a granddaughter who is a county deputy in Cass County. I think this is the right thing to do. He should be, there should be a memorial, I believe, for any state trooper that is killed in the line of duty, and at no cost to the state. I just think this is the right thing to do.
Thank you, Representative. Are there comments or questions from the committee? Anyone from the audience wish to testify? All right. I'll go ahead. Seeing none, I'll renew my motion to re-refer file 4174 to the Transportation Finance Committee. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Boston. Okay. And next up is House File 3982, Anderson P. Welcome, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So I will make the motion to refer House File 3982 to Transportation Finance. I don't know if we don't, well, we do have an amendment.
Yes.
So we'll take that up. It's the author's amendment. And to get it in the shape that he prefers. So all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. So please go ahead, Representative Anderson. Tell us about your bill.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This bill has been kind of fun to work on. I was contacted last summer by my testifier here, a retired Marine, and he had purchased a Humvee and, to his frustration, couldn't get it licensed or registered to operate it on the streets and highways of Minnesota. And did some investigating, and we do have a separate class for being able to use these vehicles in parades and special occasions and things like that, but to get it registered for street legal use has been a bit of a challenge. We had the bill drawn up, and then we worked with the Department of Vehicle Services folks. They came up with the amendment. They had some concerns with the titling and branding and addressing clarity, so the amendment we feel takes care of that. So we think we have our T's crossed and I's dotted, whatever, and would like to make it available that a vehicle, it's a Humvee produced militarily, but the same kind of civilian vehicle produced would be available to be licensed and registered here in Minnesota. I'd like to introduce my testifier, Mr. Moore from Albany.
If I could, though, first, Mr. Representative Anderson, how many of these vehicles might there be that could be on the road, reclassified or...
Right now, the...
Go ahead and introduce yourself for the committee and tell us who you represent.
Good afternoon. My name is Craig Moore, and I really don't represent anybody other than myself. And anybody else, I guess, that has purchased one of these government vehicles. These government vehicles, the Humvees, are being phased out by the military for a much safer vehicle for the troops. So... what do they do with them? They auction them off. And that's how I got mine, was through a government auction. Now, the Humvee itself was commercially manufactured for sale to the public in 1992. Same platform, same body style, same weight, same motor. And these... I don't understand why we can't, you know, title a vehicle that is already titleable if it's just done in a civilian version. The only thing that's different about the civilian version is it has a few more amenities. It has probably air conditioning and radio. These are pretty bare minimum items.
Very good. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for the testifier. Does your vehicle, has it been repainted or does it have any insignia?
I have
please go through the chair.
If you want to take a look at them, that's fine. It is just military camel. And you can pass those around and look at them if you want. All vehicles have been demilitarized by the government, so there is no weaponry, no radios from the government. It's, I guess, safe to drive by anybody. The only stipulation is when you do buy these, you cannot sell them to a foreign country.
Makes sense. Okay. All right. Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if this speak to Mr. Moore or the representative, but Representative Anderson, I know when we sell decommissioned police cars and fire vehicles just to civilians, they have to repaint them for police cars. Maybe that's something we should be looking at, too. You don't want somebody to mistake this for a military vehicle. I know all the other accoutrements have been taken off, but I am concerned about the color staying, the camouflage, or any other insignias that might still remain within the paint. So just something to think about as the bill moves forward.
Representative Barcy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier,
yes.
I tried to buy one of these a couple of years ago, so I know exactly what you're up against, but a couple of the other questions that maybe you could address, you've probably looked into this a little deeper. Do you have any problems with like the OSHA requirements or EPA requirements? I know there's no airbags in here, the bumpers are different. Some of those kind of safety features that are mandatory on other vehicles, did you have any kind of issue? Does this address all of that, take care of it, we're good now?
Mr. Moore?
I'm sorry.
So address me and then I will allow you to speak to him.
Madam Chair. Right now, all of the safety concerns that the state requires any vehicle to have of its age are met. There is signals, horns, rear view mirrors, seat belts. There is nothing on that vehicle that would stop it from being used in on the state. It covers everything that the state requires for safety.
Representative Barr, can you follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. EPA requirements?
There is
none. Mr. Moore.
Ma'am, I'm sorry. I don't know how these proceedings work. I'm just never mind.
You're doing fine.
The EPA, from what I've understood, according to the people that are auctioning these for the government, they are excluded from the EPA.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson, I hope that you don't consider changing, having the law change that they have to paint the vehicle. I mean, the camouflage is part of the attraction of why one would want to buy it, I would presume. Similar to that of a police car, black and white, obviously they have to take off the sirens, but there's no law prohibiting them from painting the vehicle, so I would hope that you'll entertain that, because that's the attraction of buying these, and of course, it's good for the government, because they make money. But did you state in your opening testifying that why they can't be driven on the highway right now? And if so, I missed it, so my sincere apologies.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. When these vehicles are sold by the government, they're stamped, their title is stamped for off-road use only. It's because of that technicality that the Minnesota law statute currently says they can't be registered because of that stamp on the title. So the change in the statute or bill that we have would say that these vehicles, if they are manufactured just like a civilian vehicle, meet all the safety aspects, they would be eligible to be licensed in Minnesota. But that's the original hang-up, is that it says
Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, just to note then, of course, we do see these on the highway. On the way up to Camp Ripley, there's a caravan, so it's not that they're not worthy of being on the road.
Correct.
So they're certainly suitable and eligible to be on our highways. We see it often in caravans. So I think that's just a worthy note for those who aren't familiar with the topic, that one does see these often on our roads, especially if you go up north up to the Camp Ripley area. So sounds like a good common sense thing, and get it done.
Did you have a follow-up, Representative Joaquin?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think maybe to clarify what I was saying, I wanted to make sure that any military insignias are not still on there. And I do have a little bit of concern. I know Representative Kosnick and I might not agree on this, is having people, because we do see these military vehicles on the road going up to Camp Ripley, to not have somebody confuse a commissioned military vehicle that's in the line of duty compared to a civilian vehicle that's out there. So that, just something to consider.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the question, I saw the pictures that were going around, and I have two questions. One is, don't look like they have a bumper on them, and that it seems to me that bumpers need to be on vehicles. Can you explain to me, did I miss something on the picture, or is there a reason can cars be on the road that don't have bumpers?
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Mr. Moore.
The rear view of the vehicle itself has got a military-style trailer hitch, and it's just a claw that goes around a round donut on the trailers. And alongside of it is a great big beefed-up steel for that to pull any type of, military trailer. The front is also got a military-style, just a half bumper. It doesn't go all the way across the front. So it does have bumpers.
Follow-up, Representative Bernardi?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My question, is there anybody in the audience that could testify whether bumpers are required on our roadways or what the law is about that? And then my second question is, hearing that the military stamps it that way, I would really want to know before this actually move forward is, why does the military stamp it that way? There must be a purpose behind it. I would really want to understand that, as well as understand the consequences of having cars that don't meet EPA standards on our roadways.
I don't see anyone in the audience that is able to answer that.
Madam Chair,
the stamp for the EPA, like I said, was right on the bid page. When you go to government, gov.com, and it's also in the letter you get. It's called an FS-92, and when that comes to you, it is stamped for off-road use only. From what I've been able to gather, for the off-road use only, it was something that the company, American General, they were the ones that originally manufactured it. They were the ones that instigated the off-road use only clause. I don't understand why they did, but it was, from what I understand, it was just the company itself that wanted it, and the government went along with it.
Okay. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have two questions. I'm not sure who can answer that. And you just partially answered one of my questions. I would just like some history about the reason that we have the current legislation that we do. And then the other is, have you looked into how other states handle this?
Representative Mason, was that a question of?
It was, yes, it's
of
either person at the table, or maybe MnDOT might have other historical
Representative Anderson, perhaps?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Mason, Wisconsin and Iowa, I believe, have the parade use. I'm not totally sure on this. In Texas also, you're available to drive these, but those are the only states that I've heard of. So there is limited use of these in other states as well.
Mm-hmm. Representative Barr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, how frequently are you thinking that you would be driving this? Is this like a recreational only, or are you going to be driving this every day? Because I'm wondering, I don't know a lot about it, but I was wondering if it might not qualify as a collector vehicle, and I think there are different rules and regs that pertain to a collector vehicle. So that was just kind of a question.
Mr. Moore?
Thank you, Manager. It would apply, and a collector vehicle, it wouldn't make that, because all it has to be is something that's 25 years or older. So this one happens to be a 1987. If you purchase anything that's newer than 25 years or older, you can't get collector plates. As far as the amount of driving, no. I don't know anybody, well, I shouldn't say that. Somebody might use it as a daily driver. Practicality, not real good, because there is no great speed to the darn thing. It takes forever to get to 30 miles an hour. So it does have power, and what I thought about using it for was plowing snow. So
okay, thank you. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify for or against the bill? All right. Welcome, sir, and give us your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Henderson. I'm the Vehicle Services Program Director for Driver and Vehicle Services. Just wanted to say the department doesn't have concerns with this bill as it is amended, but there have been some questions that I thought we could answer some of those. When these vehicles are purchased from the government at the Iron Planet, Iron Planet is the auction site that these vehicles are sold at. The government makes it very clear to buyers that these vehicles do not meet federal safety standards and they are not responsible for EPA standards. So the buyers are aware of this. They have to sign a disclosure statement. The titles are stamped off-road only vehicles. I'm not sure why the government has done it. I've heard the General Motors claim. I don't know that. But they are stamped as off-road only vehicles. In Minnesota, when we title and register a vehicle, we title and register a vehicle for on-road use only. We don't title like ATVs. And so that's why we have not titled and registered this vehicle. With the change of law, we would be able to. Somebody asked, what do other states do? AMVA, the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, took a survey last summer of members. 30 states and one Canadian province responded. Mixed practices. 50% of states allow them on roads, 50% don't. So there are mixed practices throughout the United States.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Mr. Moore?
As far as off-road use only, in Minnesota, there is a document. If you own a dirt bike, just strictly for off-road use, you can get this affidavit, go through the checklist, sign it at the bottom, send it into the state, and they will issue you a title for that particular bike. Nobody inspects a bike. It is your word and your word only. There is nothing like that for a vehicle. I checked, and I just thought it was peculiar that they'd have that for a motorcycle, and as far as, you know, the fear of people with ATVs using them on road, it's no different than a dirt bike.
Okay. Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm thinking about this as to the frequency of it. You know, you get a lot of folks buy retired fire engines and run them in parades, and you got the ambulances and different vehicles like that, and I have no problem with this. I can't imagine that the numbers are too great, and, you know, Representative Anderson probably needs one of these in a parade out in Starbucks. So I think they're kind of fun and make a good duck hunting vehicle. You know?
All right, hearing no other questions or comments, I'll renew my motion to re-refer House File 3982 as amended to Transportation Finance. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Anderson. And Representative Nash is up next. House File 3997. Welcome, Representative Nash.
Members, Madam Chair.
I will remove your motion, or move your bill, Representative. House File 3789, oops, sorry, 3997 to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm here today to talk about a way that people who are on a motorcycle learner's permit can experience driving on the interstate, which is something that we all would like to make sure that they have the ability to operate and have the experience of doing such. It's a pretty straightforward bill. It basically says that they have the ability now, if this were to become law, to, under their learner's permit, operate on the interstate. Members, you know, it's something that we would like to make sure that they have the experience of doing before they get on the interstate after they get their full license. So pretty straightforward. And Madam Chair, in the interest of brevity, I do have some testifiers, and they will themselves be quite brief.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Welcome, gentlemen. Please give us your name for the record.
Sure.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Frank Ernst. I represent American Bikers for Awareness, Training, and Education, commonly referred to as ABATE of Minnesota. I want to talk a little bit today about differentials in highways that motorcyclists have to ride on. And if I may, I will use a comparison of Highway 94 and U.S. Highway 10 west of the Twin Cities. If you're riding on Interstate Highway 94, you can rely on the fact that most of your traffic will be entering or exiting from your right-hand side. It will be doing so at or near a posted speed limit. There's no cross traffic to deal with. There are no stoplights or stop signs to deal with. And traffic may only stop for emergencies. On that highway, the speed limit is 70 miles an hour, and we do not let motorcyclists with a learner's permit ride on that road. Compare that to U.S. Highway 10. You have traffic entering from the left or the right. Traffic is often entering at a much slower speed than the traffic that's moving. Traffic exiting is doing it at a much slower speed than posted as well. You have cross traffic. You have stop lights. Traffic can stop most any place along the highway that the driver seems appropriate. And the maximum speed limit is 65 miles an hour. We do let motorcyclists subject themselves to them kind of risks. The greatest hazard of traveling on a four-lane highway is T-bone accidents. It's a huge risk. We feel that by allowing learning motorcyclists, the opportunity between driving on an interstate or on, for example, U.S. Highway 10, they may be able to avoid a lot of the risks associated with four-lane high-speed highways. And so we would like to see the sentence restricting that removed from our laws, and we would ask that you support this. ABATE of Minnesota has voted unanimously that we would support this. The Minnesota Motorcycle Safety Advisory Task Force has voted that they would support this change, and we encourage you to vote in favor as well. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And introduce yourself, please. Welcome. And
thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Cameron Kepi, and I'm just going to go through a brief discussion of how this change in the bill came about. My son, Austin, wanted to be like his dad and go out and ride motorcycle. And I was like, well, okay, you know, go through and get your permit and all that stuff. And he did. On June 19th last year, the day was good. He was going to go out and ride his motorcycles the day after Father's Day. And I was at work, and the phone rang, and it was my son. He was in a motorcycle accident. He was on Highway 10. When I asked him earlier about, you know, why he was going to go out and ride on Highway 10, he said, well, I'm restricted to not ride on the freeway or on the interstate system. And I have gone through motorcycle safety training. It happened to be in South Dakota, but one thing that is drilled into motorcycle safety is really it's all the cross traffic. That's where your motorcycle accidents happen. That's where your deadly accidents happen. So when I came into work the next day, I knew Frank was part of ABATE and a very advocate motorcycle person. I said, Frank, I don't understand why they would restrict a person on one of the safest roads out there with no cross traffic to not be allowed to drive on there. So that's kind of how this change was initiated, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Can you just tell us, as far as the time period of the instruction permit, is that very similar to the vehicle permit then? At the ages and the length of time you're called in on that permit?
A motorcycle instruction permit is valid for 12 months. You take a written test, you get that permit, and it's a $21 fee, and if you don't move on and get a full endorsement within 12 months, then you would have to do the whole permit thing over again.
All right. Thank you. There are questions from the committee? Okay. Anyone from the audience wishing to speak for or against the bill? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're breaking records here, Representative. So I'll renew my motion to re-refer House File 3997 to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we can take Representative Garofalo. I see he's here. So, House File 2751. Welcome, Representative, and I'll move your bill, House File 2751, and it's going to go to Public Safety. So please go ahead. Tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, thank you very much for the hearing, and members of the committee appreciate this opportunity. First of all, there's a DE2 amendment that I would like to move at this time. Well, I guess if someone on the committee could move it, it would be helpful.
Sure. I'll move that amendment, the DE2, delete everything. So all in favor of that, to getting it in the shape the author wishes. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. All right, go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As we see more and more electric vehicles being purchased by consumers and in the transportation sector, what we're having more businesses and more public facilities do is invest significant amounts of resources in electric vehicle charging infrastructure. This allows people, solves range anxiety, gives people the opportunity to have their vehicles charged when they're at locations. Unfortunately, sometimes people with gas mobiles think that they can park in these spots and that they're somehow like optional parking spots. But the reality is that businesses and the public are making significant investments in charging infrastructure to make those available to electric vehicle owners. So what this bill does is it allows for the opportunity if the landowner who has invested in this, if they want it to be, is that a person could be cited for parking their gas mobile in an electric vehicle parking spot. And so really, it's right now there's some confusion about whether this can or can't happen. This would allow for minimum standards and conformity across the state so that, again, optionally, when people have invested in this infrastructure, they are reserved for electric vehicles. And the answer to the question is, yes, this did happen to me, and yes, it bothers me when I see it. So that's the synopsis of the bill. I believe there's some people from the public who wish to testify, and then I'm happy to take any questions from members of the committee.
Okay, let's start with member questions. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, don't these Teslas come with a standard equipment of 400 feet of cord?
Representative Garofalo.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Hertas, no, they don't. But the important thing is that when we have these, you know, it costs a lot of money to set up these EV spots, and they're meant for charging electric vehicles. And all kidding aside, my vehicle has a large enough of a battery that I really don't need to use this stuff often. Tesla has a separate supercharging infrastructure that I utilize. But it is important for a lot of other all-electric vehicles that are out there. And as we're seeing more and more of these vehicles coming forward, it's just important that the public is educated on this and aware of it.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
Representative Garofalo, I've noticed that one of these things has emerged as a charging station here in the state office building parking ramp. I haven't looked at it that closely. Do you have to, like, swipe a credit card to plug it in, or who's paying for that?
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair and Representative Hertzos, most of the charging infrastructure uses, at least that I use, something called ChargePoint. And so it's something you put on your key. You can have a credit card linked to it. Some of them, the owner of the facility will cover the electric charges because they actually are quite minimal. For an electric vehicle, the gas equivalent of it is about 35 cents a gallon. So some places will cover it. Sometimes they charge your account, but it really depends upon on a facility-by-facility basis. The one that's over in the MnDOT ramp next to ours, I think I plugged into it once before, and I don't think they charge the electricity. But again, if you were plugged in for an hour, you're talking like a quarter or 30 cents.
Okay. All right, Representative McDonald.
Follow up. So it sounds like we need split parking fees for our parking in the ramp here.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Representative Hertzos, that's over in the MnDOT parking ramp. I'm not aware of any charging in the SLB parking ramp. Maybe there is. I don't know. I don't use it, so whatever.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make this quick. Representative Garofalo, would this include cars that have a automatic start, electric start, huh?
Representative
Garofalo. No, the differentiating factor, Representative McDonald, is whether it's an all-electric vehicle or not. Are you trying to be funny and I'm missing the joke? Or
can we get another question from the
DFLers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. No, Representative Garofalo, I don't have to try to be funny. I stand funny. No, I am. You know, the more of these stations get put in, the less there's us gas-guzzling hogs will have a place to park. So I'm just a little particular about that. But I support your Tesla and your cause.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, be careful what you wish for. No, just kidding. No, on lines, just a quick question clarifying maybe. On lines 2.22 and 2.23, the owner or manager of the property where the parking space is, I know in Hopkins we have a city lot that has four electric spots that people can buy permits for, but then we also, in our grocery store lot, there's a private company with, in conjunction with the grocery store, has put in a rapid charge that's paid for. I'm not sure how their lease requirement goes, so if it's a situation like that, which would it be the company that's running the rapid charge, or would it be the grocery store that would be responsible for policing that or calling it in? I don't know if we needed more clarifying, because there are a lot of public-private partnerships like that, or partnerships. Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair and Representative, the intent of the language as it's written is to be who owns the property. So I know a lot of times there are public partnerships that incentivize this charging infrastructure. I believe the way the language is designed and the way I read it is it's agnostic on that. It doesn't care about it. It's really about who the landowner is. And again, it's voluntary. It doesn't require it.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. Just a clarifying question, and I think the intent is really clear. Maybe this change doesn't need to be made, but we, on line 1.5 to 1.7, we define electric vehicle parking space, and then we're also defining electric vehicle station. It seems the intent is that an electric vehicle parking space would have a charging facility, but the electric vehicle parking space doesn't look like it says that it has to have that charging station. So what would an electric vehicle parking space purpose be if there wasn't a charging station there?
Representative Garofalo.
I believe I understand your question, Representative Whalen, and let me just reread it really quick here. On its face, I would say that perhaps there are some parking spaces where maybe a private sector business wanted to give preferential treatment to an electric vehicle owner for a preferred parking space, maybe, without the charging infrastructure. But that would just be an educated guess on my part. But I'm trying to think of when I have ever seen that, and I haven't. So it doesn't mean it can't exist. But
okay. How about to the testifier? Do you want to add some
information for us, please.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Andrew Twight with Fresh Energy. We're a nonprofit organization that provides research and analysis on energy policy in Minnesota. Here to express our support for the bill. Because, as Representative Garofalo said, as more and more consumers buy EVs, more and more businesses invest in this charging infrastructure, I think it just makes sense to make sure that this infrastructure is used for its intended purpose. We also support the amended language because I believe it provides a clear framework for the spaces, like you said, Representative Garofalo. I've never seen them. But if a business or a local government wanted to put in a space that was just for EVs, even if it didn't have charging infrastructure, for businesses that choose to do that, to be able to have a clear and consistent guidelines throughout the state. So we thank Representative Garofalo for authoring the bill and you all for your consideration.
Okay. Thank you, sir. I believe there are several others who wish to testify. You want to come forward, please? Welcome, sir. Give us your name for the record and do proceed.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Brendan Jordan. I facilitate Drive Electric Minnesota, which is an electric vehicle partnership including automakers, auto dealers, electric utilities and co-ops, and other stakeholders. I'll be very brief. The state of Minnesota has a growing interest in electric vehicles and a growing charging infrastructure, but a number of studies suggest that the level of infrastructure is limited. There are often times where somebody needs to make a trip and there's really only one charger available. You might look on your phone app and say, you know what, I can get all the way to Duluth if I stop in Pine City and pull in and find that somebody's parked there. That can be a significant inconvenience for an owner. By and large, this investment in public infrastructure has been made by private investors. It takes place on private property, and really this just relates to the ability of people operating and hosting these stations to allow them to be used for their intended purpose. We Drive Electric Minnesota is supportive of this provision, and thank you very much for hearing it in committee.
Very good. Thank you. Can I just ask, do you happen to know how many EVs were sold in Minnesota last year and what the percentage increase over the previous year was?
Madam Chair, I know that we've hit just over 6,000 total registrations in the state. I don't have the data in front of me. I think that it's been in the neighborhood of 500 sales a year for the past few years. It might be a little higher in the previous year.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
Is there anyone else wishes to testify? Welcome, sir. And please give us your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for giving me this opportunity. My name is Stephen Ronning, and I represent only myself as an electric vehicle owner. I only have a couple of things to add to the testimony that's already been given. I will briefly just give a quick story from literally this last weekend where the Edina Galleria, they have two electric vehicle charging stations that use a standard that's usable for all electric vehicles. And then they also have two Tesla-only charging stations, so four stations in total.
I'm sorry.
I would really encourage this committee to consider the fact that electric vehicles, Tesla is kind of the big name that gets heard out. We've even made jokes about it here. But the fact that the vast majority of people that are going to be using electric vehicles now in the state and moving forward are not going to be Tesla owners. I spent the part of the weekend in the parking lot because people who did not have electric vehicles were blocking the spaces that are assigned for electric vehicles and just having some conversations with them. And a couple of things that came out from that conversation was, well, why don't they just make more charging stations so that I can park in this space? And I made the point back. I said that it's difficult for us to know how many of these charging stations are actually being used and how much charging is needed in our infrastructure in Minnesota when they get blocked. So I would encourage this bill to move forward as being able to help us get the data to be able to do that. Similarly, thinking about as we move forward, the new vehicles, yes, they do have longer range, over 200 miles in cases. However, there are older vehicles and used vehicles that have less range. And I have friends who, for example, they bought an electric vehicle, they need in the winter, this last winter was extremely cold. We got below 14 degrees, below zero. Their range gets drastically diminished. And there are people who, if their only vehicle is an electric vehicle, and they plan to go to a grocery store that has installed one of these chargers, and then they get there and they're not able to park, they are now stranded. And so it's important that we consider for these people, if businesses are building this infrastructure and encouraging people to come to their business, that we should help support them. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Garofalo, I see on page 2 that there are a few exemptions to gas-guzzling vehicles being able to park in these spaces. I do not, however, see an exemption. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I do not see an exemption if the parking lot is otherwise full. There are a couple of parking lots that I sometimes frequent that have EV spaces, but they are also crowded parking lots, and there are not always spots available. Would you consider adding an additional exemption for parking lots that are otherwise full?
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Representative New, no, I would not.
All right. Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Garofalo. This reminds me of the time I presented an EV bill on the floor and was peppered with all sorts of questions as well. But you're doing a great job, and I think this is a wonderful bill, and I just wanted to note that in the DE amendment, I think we now have for the first time, a section of law for this purpose. So thank you for that.
So, Representative, if the electric charging stations, they appear to be the choke point, right? I mean, we're not going to have thousands of these vehicles in Minnesota unless there are thousands of stations being installed.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, unlike with gas mobiles where you fill up your car at gas stations, the overwhelming majority of vehicle charging is done at home. So people, what is the most common place for vehicles to charge is overnight. People have their vehicle plugged in. They can have a level 2 charger. Charges anywhere from 25 to 30 miles per hour. So every night when a person's sleeping, it's like someone takes their car to the gas station and fills it up and bring it back. The purpose of employer charging, retail establishments having these charging, it's really an ancillary service. It's not even going to ever be close to a majority of the charging that takes place. So try to think of it, if you could, in the context, not as a gas station fill up, but as really someone if they're on a long trip, or perhaps they're at a hotel staying overnight, or for some businesses, they see it as an amenity to show people that, you know, having electric vehicles tends to be a positive branding message. It's seen as forward thinking, it's seen as modern, and businesses like to be associated with that.
All right, sounds good, thanks. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then we'll go ahead and I'll renew my motion to move House File 2751 to transportation to public safety. As amended. Okay. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's my re-election bill. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to move on to... House File 4164, Representative Metza.
Who's the guy taking the camera?
We should find out. Representative Metza, 4164, we're going to bring that before the committee and move it to Transportation Finance. So please go ahead with your bill.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair and members. This has been actually, first off, I should say, big thank you from the family as well. I know you got this in on short notice, and they weren't able to make it down today on short notice. But this has been a work in progress now for a few years in naming a bridge that a young soldier from my district who came home with PTSD and ended up committing suicide. Essentially, we had to go through a lot of due diligence in talking with different military organizations, our local veterans and Legion groups, and ended up in a position where we felt comfortable moving forward in recognizing his service and the importance of bringing more attention to those issues by naming this bridge after him. And it's a little bridge right when you're pulling into Eveleth that his family drives by every day. And essentially, we just want to recognize that there are issues, especially in rural Minnesota and other rural areas throughout the country, where a lot of our veterans do come from. And this would make a marker for his family and be a remembrance for them and others who struggle with PTSD and other mental health issues when they come home.
Thank you, Representative Metzoff. So are there comments or questions from the committee? Anyone from the audience wish to testify? Okay, seeing none then, we'll proceed to renew the motion for House File 4164 to be moved to Transportation Finance Committee. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Metzoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Okay, and our, is that the last bill? No. Okay, Representative Knobloch, House File 1722. Welcome, Representative Knobloch. So we're going to have your bill, House File 1722, before us, and it will move on to Transportation Finance.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Welcome, and please tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1722 is a simple bill. It requires the state to open negotiations with BNSF Railway about extending North Star commuter rail service to St. Cloud, subject to certain conditions. These conditions include there be no additional cost to the state for the extension, that there be at least two trains a day in St. Cloud, one being a reverse commute, allowing the rerouting of some existing service, and prohibiting the Met Council from having any additional involvement in St. Cloud besides that related to the North Star Corridor. The basic concept is to use existing assets more efficiently. Thus, instead of building any new train stations, we would use the existing Amtrak passenger station in St. Cloud that already has a couple of Amtrak trains a day. We would not build any additional stations in Becker or Clear Lake, as has sometimes been proposed. It is anticipated that the scheduling could be done in such a way that there would not be a need for any additional rolling stock. There is an existing spur off the existing BNSF line next to the existing Amtrak station that could accommodate the North Star train in St. Cloud if needed. And I would have you look at this chart that I actually had prepared by a railroad consultant friend of mine that talks about how the number of miles you would have the train run each week underneath one scenario where you dropped one of the existing round trips out of Big Lake and then extended two round trips up to St. Cloud each day would result in almost exactly the same number of miles each week traveled by the train. Right now, the train is traveling 2,941 miles a week. If you did that particular scenario, the train would travel 2,981 miles a week, just 40 miles longer, but of course it wouldn't be making as many stops. And I guess the point of it is that by rerouting these assets we have that are underutilized because North Star has never come close to meeting its original projections of capacity, by rerouting the train, you can have it run basically over the same number of miles just in different places and keep the operating costs the same. This plan actually, I think, could have the possibility of even saving the state some money. You would have the additional fare revenue out of St. Cloud that you don't have right now with seemingly very little additional operating costs. I also have had discussions with BNSF in the past, and they're not opposing the bill. They're not in favor of it either. But my sense is that because the tracks that they have that are closer to the Twin Cities are utilized more than the tracks as you go further away from the Twin Cities up by St. Cloud, that they, because of other scheduling issues with their freight trains, their oil trains and such, would be interested in this sort of a concept. There is a lot of additional potential for additional traffic on the North Star from St. Cloud, and I have here with me Teresa Bonin, who's the president of the St. Cloud Chamber of Commerce, to talk about that.
Welcome, Ms. Bonin, and please tell us your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Teresa Bonin, and I'm the president of the St. Cloud Area Chamber of Commerce that represents about a 30-mile radius around St. Cloud and over 1,000 business members in our community. Representative Knobloch's bill has been discussed for a fair amount of time, at least a year, in our community, and really is creating quite excitement in our business community that we would finally have North Star delivered into the St. Cloud proper area to bring people in and also to move them back into the Twin Cities area. I'd like to address today two things. First, the demand for North Star service, and second, the economic impact that our service can have on the St. Cloud area. Currently, North Star Link, a bus, runs multiple times a day back and forth to Big Lake, delivering riders and then bringing them back to St. Cloud. The daily riders are at about 3,300 per month. About 85% of those are weekday, and that has been stable now for a number of months. The demand comes from workers who are moving to and from St. Cloud, either coming from the Minneapolis area to work in St. Cloud or out of St. Cloud to work in the Northern Twin Cities and Minneapolis area. There's a number of leisure travelers for sporting activities as well as concerts. We have a lot of students that move back and forth to St. Cloud State, St. Cloud Technical and Community College, St. John, St. Ben's, and also our private colleges, as well as those who families live in St. Cloud and are moving back and forth from the University of Minnesota and other Twin Cities campuses. Also, the airport is a big draw, as well as virtually every demographic in St. Cloud has a reason to use this service. Movement between St. Cloud and Minneapolis is absolutely critical, and as we also develop Highway 94 and what is to come there with new lanes and other things that we'd like to see there, this is an important asset for us to kind of relieve some of that pressure on Highway 94. So if you build it, they will come. We think that eliminating the bus transfer in Big Lake will absolutely drive a dramatic increase in ridership overall. Secondly, spurring economic development. This Amtrak station that is being proposed to be used for this connection is on our east side, which has long had plans for development, and we're seeing them move ahead right at this time. The use of the current Amtrak depot is cost efficient to start, and its successive ridership will drive station improvements, and it will drive private investment in that station area, which is already coming into play. CentraCare Health, our workforce center, and other partners are currently planning a new partnership venture in an existing building not far from this station. Quick Trip, which has recently opened 12 new stores in our community, has 10 more on the books, and one of them is in the immediate vicinity of this station. A local developer also has plans on the books and is moving forward with a substantial development near the station. So two consistent messages are being delivered to the legislature from our business community. First of all, we want to ensure that there is a two-way commute schedule to accommodate St. Cloud employers. We want workers coming to us in the same amount or more as those that are going out from St. Cloud so that we don't cannibalize our own workforce. So that two-way commute and having people come into work and accommodate those work schedules to St. Cloud is an important part of this proposal. And secondly, we really encourage the legislature and also federal Congress to allow North Star in St. Cloud to be a success and to support the already substantial state and federal investments of the past in North Star. Complete this service before you move ahead with other areas of the state. Let us be the success that drives future rail development throughout the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. And do we have Representative Bernardi?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to make sure that you know that I have an amendment later. And then also I have some questions about this. And I particularly on lines 2.7 of the bill to 2.9. But before I get into that one, I'm going to first ask, do you know when a fiscal note will be coming regarding this bill?
Representative Knobloch.
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, there have been some in the past. I don't know that there's going to be an updated one this year. You know, the fiscal notes on this have been, you know, rather interesting to see. I think when I first brought out this bill a couple years ago, they were $150 million, something like that. By the time we were finished it, that they were more in the $20 million range. But really, there isn't any cost to doing this if you can't make an agreement with the railway. I mean, BNSF owns these tracks. We have an agreement with the railroad right now that they've given us right away over certain portions of the tracks at certain times that the existing North Star is running on. If BNSF says, no, we're not interested in talking anymore, well, that's it. I mean, there's no cost to making a long-distance phone call to BNSF and Dallas-Fort Worth and finding out or talking to them some. My sense, though, is that they would have some interest in it and that there would actually be, from their standpoint, some advantage in dropping one of the existing round-trip trains out of Big Lake, because that interferes some twice a day with their existing freight service that they've got to pencil in or have right in there at a specific time. This train that's starting in Big Lake and moving on into Minneapolis, and then again in the evening, the same thing on the way out. And as those lines have gotten busier since we made that agreement with BNSF years ago, as you look at all the oil trains and other things that are going down the track, this has become more inconvenient. So my sense is that BNSF likes the concept behind this, and you know, until you start talking with them, you know, you don't know what cost, if any, there would be. There's no cost to the bill passing it now because it specifically says you can't spend additional money on it.
Okay, so Madam Chair.
Representative Bernardi.
So the follow-up to that is the lines 2.7 to 2.9 talks about the Department of Transportation is prohibited from committing to spend any more state funds on operating costs than the total sum in and the Met Council have budgeted for the North Star Corridor. I want to ask you, because last your past bills, I know, would have affected the stations in Fridley where that I represent, and we're taking service away from them, trying to get this, like, no fiscal note or those kinds of things was actually hurting other parts of the service. And so it's kind of a twofold question. One is, does your bill put other spots along the rail line at risk for their service, which I know you just mentioned Big Lake? Are there any other areas that are at risk for reduction in their service? And frankly, I would like it to go to St. Cloud, but not at the expense of my community. And then secondly, I'm just trying to figure out the additional cost to get it up there. Is that going to be bared by the counties? And I don't know if it's just one county or two counties it goes through, right? I don't know exactly where it goes. But are you guys going to bear the cost? Or are you going to, because when it was first built, Anoka, Hennepin, Sherburne counties paid for, the regional rail authorities paid quite a bit of money to do this. Is there going to be expenses from other counties to St. Cloud? And will it impact the rail authorities and costs for the counties that are already on the line?
Representative Knobloch.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi asked quite a few questions there. So let me try to answer them, and if I miss something, please ask the question for what I missed. Now, first of all, the bill is the same as when you saw it last time. It doesn't require service necessarily. Well, I mean, it anticipates that there would be some service changes, and that right now you have five trains a day out of Big Lake going into Minneapolis. They stop, you know, at a number of stops on the way, including the one in Fridley that I think is in your legislative district. Also, right now, current service is one reverse commute. So you've got, you know, essentially six trains running on the tracks in the morning and six trains running on the track in the evening. Five going in the morning, five coming out. And it doesn't have to work out this way, but the particular chart that I showed you where the operating cost looks like it would be about neutral would anticipate that instead of having five coming in the morning from Big Lake, including five stops at Fridley, that you would have four. And part of the reasoning behind it is that North Star's never come close to hitting its original projections. I think it's at about 70% of what they projected in ridership, and so there's certainly plenty of capacity on these trains In my mind, if you've got four trains instead of five and you like riding the train, I suspect people that are riding the train will still be interested in just riding a different train, so I don't think you're going to lose much in ridership from that standpoint. But the money you save will then allow it to be extended up to St. Cloud. I guess I don't know if that answers all your questions. If I've missed something, let me know.
Yes, Madam Chair. I want to talk about the initial cost to get the rail built up there and who would bear that cost and the operating costs, what it's going to cost your county and what it would cost my county. Anything?
Well,
Representative Knobloch.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, I mean, again, the state does not own the rail line. The state doesn't own any part of the rail line where the train is running now. The state doesn't own any part of the rail line that goes up to St. Cloud. BNSF Railway owns all the lines. Now, the cost of doing this is less than it would have been a number of years ago because BNSF, at its own expense several years ago, put in a second rail line for the 12 miles between Becker and the Twin Cities that previously didn't have a double track. And they felt they needed a double track if they were going to add this service back when it was being negotiated years ago. That was one of the problems with running it all the way up to St. Cloud is the additional cost of adding that double track. Since that time, all the oil trains and other additional freight service has caused BNSF to build that track on their own. So we're not talking about building any new track. That's not anticipated. I don't believe it would be necessary.
All right. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Knobloch, this is an interesting bill. And for as long as I've known, everyone has always thought that the North Star should have gone to St. Cloud in the first place. And it is my understanding, and maybe you can add some clarification, that when that legislation for the North Star was passed, that it was changed from St. Cloud to Big Lake, and that was mainly, you are given the credit for that. So is there a change, you know, are you changing your position on how the North Star should have been? And again, no question, it should go to, there should be the train going to North to St. Cloud. I mean, that's a big, big asset, I would think, for the community and for the people that go back and forth.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Mason, I certainly had nothing to do with the train originally going to St. Cloud and then me somehow deciding it should go to Big Lake instead. No, that was never a position of mine. What happened at the time is in the funding for the North Star Corridor, there was a 50% federal match. And the federal government, in looking at the cost to extend the train up to St. Cloud, including the cost of putting the double track that I mentioned for 12 miles south of Big Lake or south of Becker, which was a considerable expense, tens of millions of dollars, might have been $100 million project. There was a lot of money to do that additional track. The federal government did a study and basically said, well, with all these additional costs, we don't think that the ridership in St. Cloud, given the cost benefit, justifies doing it. And so we, federal government, are only going to provide the federal match to go to Big Lake. And because of that, the project only went to Big Lake. Now things have changed. The double track is there. BNSF has built it, so it's a different situation.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Or is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against? Okay, Representative Hornstein.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I just was hoping MnDOT would weigh in on this. I don't know if they're coming to see.
Apparently, we do. Right. If they're here, that would be fine. Otherwise, you are? Okay. All right, please have a seat and give us your name for the record and who you represent, sir.
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much. My name is Ryan Wilson. I work for the Department of Transportation. I am the director of the transit section in our metro district.
Welcome.
A couple of comments. Thank you. A couple of comments on the House file as proposed. I just feel it's important to note that
as written, it would be a bill that MnDOT would want to undertake with a whole range of local partners, cities, counties, the St. Paul Metropolitan Transit Organization Committee, there we go, committee is the right word, Metro Transit, who's the owner and operator of North Star today. That would be a pivotal piece of this legislation. We did note a couple of concerns with the bill as written. One, again, with Metro Transit being the owner and operator of the line today, MnDOT would, kind of the requirements as written, would suggest MnDOT negotiating requirements on behalf of other entities with each other, which might be a little tricky, something that would require some close coordination. Some of the terms are also perhaps out of MnDOT's control, meaning operating requirements between, say, Amtrak and St. Paul, St. Cloud Metropolitan Transit Commission. And also noteworthy that there is not any funding provided for MnDOT staff time and probably, importantly, any consultant work that would be necessary to support design and engineering activities, possible legal fees or other actions or requirements that might be required to be studied in negotiations with BNSF Railway.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony, sir. Did you have a comment, Representative?
Well, Madam Chair, yeah, just one thing that I that Mr. Wilson's testimony brought to mind, also that Representative Bernardi asked about, is, I mean, we do allow local governments to be involved with this. There is language in the bill that talks about the St. Cloud MTC cooperating with the Metropolitan Council. Certainly, you know, if the city of St. Cloud, if Benton County, where the Amtrak station is located, or Sherburn County, where the train would run through, want to be involved or want to contribute tax dollars, that's certainly available. I know that the city of St. Cloud has, as Teresa Bonin said, some redevelopment plans up in the area of the Amtrak station, so I wouldn't be surprised if they're interested in putting in some sales tax dollars or something to a redevelopment project that would involve this if the train, in fact, was to come there. But, you know, there is provision for local governments being involved in it. And, you know, as far as engineering costs and that sort of thing, you know, I think that's the next step beyond this bill. I mean, this bill is about talking to BNSF and seeing, are they interested in doing this? Would they be interested in doing this shifting of service around? You know, do they have identified costs they think would have to be incurred in doing this or not? And so this would really be the first step. And if you negotiated with them and, you know, they came back here and said, well, yeah, there are these additional costs and here is what they are, well, then we would have to decide, coming back before this committee, are those costs worth considering or aren't they, depending on what they are. But I just see this as a first step before some of the things that you're talking about, Mr. Wilson.
Okay. Representative Hornstein?
Thank you. I just, you know, want to thank Representative Knobloch. I have some concerns about this bill, but, you know, cutting the service to Big Lake, but I think it's, I think the representative from the Chamber of Commerce, you know, made good points about the advantages of rail in this corridor. And I think it'd be good to pass a rail bill out of this committee, even though, again, I share MnDOT's concerns and the concerns that Representative Bernardi mentioned. But, you know, and I think, Representative Bernardi, you have an amendment. Are you still going to be pushing that? I think that amendment might be the way to go. We can get some general fund money into this and start to really seriously plan. And I'd love to, you know, work together on this. It's a really, really important that we get this up to St. Cloud. And, you know, so to get the ball rolling, it's a good thing. But I think that the DE1 would be a good way to do that. I wasn't sure you were going to do that, so I'm glad you are. And I appreciate you bringing this forward.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Under the amendment? Okay. Did you, Representative Bernardi, wanted to do your amendment?
Sure, Madam Chair. I would like to move the DE1 amendment.
Very good. Okay. Right. You present it to the committee.
Thank you. So this would substitute the language for what Representative Hornstein was just talking about, and that would be an $850,000 appropriation from the general fund for the Commissioner of Transportation to study the extension of the North Star commuter rail line to St. Cloud. And it goes into what that agreement could include, which could be a feasibility study, but not limited to that. And This appropriation is available for 2 years after the year of the appropriation. So I think this is our best bet to really, if we're really serious about making this happen and getting results quicker, I think this is the most direct route to make this happen, to get this extension line from the Metro to St. Cloud. And this isn't talking to my amendment, but I'm really concerned about the bill we have and how it doesn't even collaborate with the current line. It has the cities up in your area, I mean the counties in your area and the city in your area, but it doesn't even talk about the community in our areas because they're going to be impacted by this legislation as well. So anyway, I think this is the better option, and I hope to get your vote.
So Representative Knobloch, any comments?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess respectfully I'd ask members to oppose the amendment. You'll notice this is a delete all amendment. I mean, it completely eliminates my bill. All it does after completely eliminating my bill is spend $850,000 on a study. There have been a number of studies on this over the years. I guess I would respectfully say that I think you're kind of getting the cart before the horse. You should do my bill, and then after you've had the discussions with BNSF and seen what they say, you know, perhaps at that point it would be appropriate to do a study. Although it always kills me when I see almost $1 million thrown around for studies around here. It seems like an awful lot of money. But I guess respectfully, I mean, this is the delete all amendment that completely guts my bill and just substitutes a study, and I'd ask members to oppose it.
Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and my question would be to Representative Bernardi on the same question of $850,000. I'm always curious where these amounts come from in terms of the depth of the study, feasibility study. That's just a lot of money. I'm just wondering, how does that number come about? Is it just kind of grabbed out of the air, or do we, you know, round to the nearest $1 million or $50,000 like we do with the everything else at the state of Minnesota here? Or I'm just curious.
Well, actually,
Bernardi.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hertas. This actually came from the governor's budget, which supplemental budget, which I'm assuming that they work closely with the Department of Transportation to find out what this would cost. So hopefully the executive branch has, which I assume has put the time and energy to finding out what the number actually should be, so it's not a number that I just pulled out of the air and said this is what we should do. So thank you for that question.
Okay, any other comments or questions on the amendment? Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to speak in favor of the amendment. As we've seen another, even with the first build-out of North Star, negotiating with the railroads takes time and energy, and it takes staff time, which does cost money. And you do get what you pay for. And I think if we're really serious about extending this line to St. Cloud, which we probably should have done to begin with when it was cheaper, we would go this route so we could have a real negotiation with BNSF. Thank you.
All right. So on the DE1 amendment, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Motion does not prevail. And we have one more testifier, it looks like. Sir, would you like to come forward? Welcome to the committee, and give us your name and who you represent, please.
Madam Chairman, my name is Jay Severance. I'm a board member of All Aboard Minnesota. We're an advocacy group for passenger rail transportation in the state of Minnesota. What I wanted to do was just paraphrase a memo that I submitted, unfortunately too late to get into the record or the handouts. Essentially, we definitely support the need for more rail transportation from St. Cloud and, for that matter, up the line to Fargo-Moorhead and in between. We are encouraging this bill to go forward because we feel it can provide a good nucleus for expanding the rail transportation in this area. We've had contacts over the last 6 months with civic leaders along this corridor, and I'm talking about St. Cloud and on up the lake to Detroit Lakes and on up to the Fargo area. And we found that there's a strong desire for rail public transportation, at various times throughout the day, not just limited to the times that a commuter line would run. So we have a basic feeling that by increasing the Amtrak trains in that corridor, we would accomplish the same thing that this would do with the North Star. That's not to say that we don't think the North Star is necessary, but we do believe that there is need throughout the day, 7 days a week, for transportation to and from the Twin Cities, St. Cloud, and Fargo-Moorhead. So without going into any further details, I did submit a memo that talks about our particular point of view. We do fully support the need for additional rail service between St. Cloud and the Twin Cities, as well as Fargo-Moorhead area. So we urge you to support HF 1722. There are other bills that are currently pending in the Transportation Finance Committee that are supporting studies for Amtrak. And we believe that those should all be considered as a unit so that we get the most appropriate and most cost-effective service for the constituents along that route.
Thank you, Mr. Severinsen.
Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no further testimony, Representative Hornstein.
I just wanted to thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make a couple of just closing comments before we vote briefly. I hope that as this moves forward, and we can maybe meld some of the approaches that the governor is talking about and that you're talking about, Mr. Chairman. I think that a study combined with some kind of forward progress with the railroads and getting more of the stakeholders involved is a good approach. So, with reservations, I support this because we can't get something for nothing. I mean, the economists say there's no free lunch, and I don't think there's no free way to do this, particularly with this cut to Big Lake, which I'm concerned about. You know, last year we had it at a different station. But this year I'm open to this, and I hope that, again, as we move forward, we can meld these approaches. I think Mr. Severinsen was right, and we've kind of moved backwards on intercity passenger rail. We had federal, the chairs of the Transportation Finance Committees in both bodies, wrote a letter nationally that we're not going to put more money into this. It's not this line, but it's other lines. And I hope that we have a more consistent message on passenger rail than we've had in the past. So hopefully, again, we'll move this forward. And this goes in a little bit of a different direction than this committee has talked about. We've talked about expanding lanes and additional lane miles as a single mode transportation option. And again, representative from the Chamber of Commerce of St. Cloud said, this is a good approach in terms of congestion relief. So it goes in a little different direction, Madam Chair, than we've gone in this committee up to date, and I hope we'll be able to keep this going forward and maybe combine some different approaches and keep this going. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Knobloch, any final statement you want to make?
No, that's okay. I appreciate Representative Hornstein's statements, and I appreciate your hearing the bill. It's an important issue for my community. I do think that, we're never going to know, what did Wayne Gretzky say? You miss 100% of the shots you never take. I mean, we're never going to know what we can do if we don't talk to the railway who owns these lines. Let's open some talks with them and see what we can get.
Very good. So I'll renew my motion to re-refer House File 1722 to Transportation Finance. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Knobloch.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, up last, House File 2930, Representative Anderson. Welcome, Representative Anderson, and I'll move that House File 2930 come before the committee and move to Transportation Finance. So welcome, and please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What this bill does is it requires the Department of Transportation to conduct a noise analysis along a segment in my legislative district. I have with me today a testifier from the district and the area involved in this, and I'd like to turn it over to him, if I could.
Very good. Welcome, sir. And please give us your name for the record and who you represent.
Yeah, my name is Roger Berkowitz. Live in Plymouth. I represent myself and a large number of my neighbors in the neighborhood.
Very good. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Okay, so a little bit nervous. Sorry about that. I just want to start out saying that I don't live directly along 494. I'm about a quarter of a mile down the hill from 494, but my home and my immediate neighbors are impacted by the freeway noise. That's been an issue since the expansion a couple of years ago, and it's also an issue for the neighbors definitely up against the freeway. I've lived in the house for 25 years. We built the house new, undeveloped land, and at the time we looked at the location of the freeway. We considered it as a potential nuisance, and through several visits to the area before building, we determined it was not an impact. And really, for the first 23 years that we lived there, freeway noise was not an impact. There's talk for years and years and years of expanding to six lanes, three lanes each direction. I'm totally in favor of that, and I think most people are. I think that was a necessary improvement to the area. What we didn't anticipate was the significant increase in noise that came as a result of that expansion. Several things were done differently. The freeway is carrying a little more volume. I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue in my particular neighborhood with the increase in noise is a concrete surface now rather than asphalt that it was previously. There's a noise wall across the freeway from us that wasn't there previously, and there's a 4 feet high concrete median down the middle of the freeway that wasn't there previously either. All of those, I believe, are directly affecting our neighborhood. Well into the process, we learned that the area had been evaluated, and MnDOT determined no noise wall would be built on our segment on our side of the highway. We were not notified of that earlier on in the process. The MnDOT process back in the, I think it was 2013 timeframe when this came out, was that they did their studies, they made their recommendations, and the neighborhoods that were to receive noise walls were notified and were given an opportunity to vote on whether they did or did not want a wall built in their neighborhood. Neighborhoods like mine at that time were given no specific individual notice. My understanding now is MnDOT has changed their process, and had this project been rolled out today, my neighborhood would have been notified early in the process about the result of their evaluation. Their results that we learned said our neighborhood did not warrant the noise wall. It's never been clear to me if the noise wall criteria is strictly based on actual sound levels produced by the highway, by modeled sound levels based on a model that MnDOT uses, or based on modeled noise reduction from a wall that would be put up. Okay. So I've gotten various information from MnDOT about that over the years. I think that if we had had earlier information about what was being done, about the study that was being done, and the results of the modeling, the results of their evaluation, we would have had earlier opportunity to look at the details that went into those models, whether they took in proper variables. Like I said, there's things about the material of construction, the noise wall on the other side, the median. I've been told by MnDOT representatives after the fact that they do not consider those types of specifics for a noise wall evaluation. They just look at some very generic parameters. Now, generic may be good in most cases or some cases, but the fact is our neighborhood has suffered a very serious decrease in the quality of life since that freeway has gone full speed both directions. Last night, for the first time in a while, the wind was blowing from the south-southwest, I noticed. Myself, my neighbor, both pointed out, we're up most of the night hearing the highway noise through our closed windows. We don't open windows in the summertime anymore because of the freeway noise. It permeates the house. We look forward to the hot weather so we could run the air conditioner. We look forward to the cold weather so we could run the heat. Time in our yards is minimized. We do not enjoy spending time in the front yard or the backyard. depending which way the wind is blowing. And that is all as a result of this highway project. So, you know, what we're looking for, ideally I'd say, please go build us a noise wall. I know I just can't ask for that and get that. I would like a closer look, a revisit to the study that was done with some oversight to make sure that the proper parameters are being evaluated and that the neighborhood gets a fair shake when it's all said and done. And we look at other areas along 494 that were affected by this project where walls did go up. There was an abandoned golf course that received a noise wall. There are neighborhoods where there were already three lanes of traffic that received noise walls. In our area, the highway was widened. The concrete was changed. The pavement was changed from asphalt to concrete. We got nothing other than more noise. Now, there is a berm along this along part of this section that MnDOT claims would not make the noise wall as effective as it could be. But I think we all agree a noise wall would help reduce noise that's coming to the neighborhood. There are several townhouses on the north end of this segment that have bedroom windows with a direct shot, probably 30 to 40 feet to the highway right-of-way with nothing blocking that view. And it's just really not a good livable situation. We've got people talking about moving because of this. We haven't seen it yet, but I fear that we're going to see home values go down. I just asked for a fair evaluation, a re-evaluation that we can take a look at that's transparent so we know that we're getting a fair deal out of this.
Okay. So. Sir, I apologize. I didn't catch your name. Yes. Do that again, please.
Roger Berkowitz.
Berkowitz. Yeah. Okay, so. Very good. Thanks for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would actually like to hear from MnDOT because we had a similar situation. So I'm very sympathetic to people who live around interstates. I live close to an interstate as well. And there's been new construction on it and becomes noisier. And I've had my constituents call and complain as well with the outcome. So I do have sympathetic with it. I do have sympathy with it. I do want to hear from MnDOT how this impacts all the other projects, because you're saying that you'd like be moved up to the top of the line. I'm not sure exactly how it's articulated in the bill. But anyway, I'd like to hear how MnDOT about the fairness for the other people who are on the 20-year list to get their sound wall. So it's not fair to you what happened. It's also not fair to the other people on the list waiting for their sound wall and need probably some remedial help on their roadway. So I'd like to hear about
Representative,
that.
I do believe there's a MnDOT person here, so why don't we bring her to the testifying table. Welcome, ma'am, to the testifying table, and please give us your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Natalie Reese. I am from MnDOT. I am the Metro District Noise and Air Quality Supervisor.
Very good. Please proceed with your testimony.
All right. Madam Chair, committee members, I just wanted to give you a little history about what MnDOT has done in this area. There was a noise study that was completed along this roadway for the 494 expansion project. It included this neighborhood where Mr. Berkowitz is from. We did analyze the noise in this area based on the existing noise conditions and also the future build conditions related to the project. The noise study showed that while the state statute noise standards were exceeded, also the federal criteria were exceeded under the future conditions. So therefore, we did analyze a noise wall in this area, but because of the existing berm, the area that it's located, it's about a 5 to 10 foot berm. So the wall that was studied is on MnDOT right-of-way in front of the berm, so it would only provide maybe an additional 10 foot height, most in areas, and it was not able to meet our criteria for cost effectiveness and noise reduction. So the wall that was analyzed, what was not able to get 7 decibels of noise reduction for one home in the area, and it was not able to get 5 decibels of noise reduction for enough homes in the area to make the wall cost effective. These are numbers that MnDOT has set. They're part of the federal rules, and they're supported also by the MPCA, who oversees the state noise statutes. We apply these consistently throughout the state for all of our projects in order to make tough decisions about where we can spend money for noise walls. We want them to work. We want them to be able to actually block noise, and we want to make sure that money's being spent in the locations where it benefits the most people.
Thank you, Ms. Reese.
You're welcome. I have just a little more, too. We did do some background and some public outreach for this project before it was built. There were public meetings held during the environmental documentation process. Also, we have been pretty responsive to other complaints after the project was built. We did some noise monitoring in the area. We've gone out to meet with residents at their homes. There was an ombudsman's case that did MnDOT study for this and produce some results. And we also met with Representative Anderson and representatives from the City of Plymouth and residents back in May 2017 to address some of these concerns as well.
Okay, Representative Bernardi?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that background. I was asking for my question specifically is, and I just have one follow-up after that. My question specifically is about fairness. You apply these standards, and there's, I believe, a waiting list of 20 years, or you have a 20-year plan for people waiting for their noise walls. So I want to apply the fairness for those people who also need noise walls.
Sure. Ms. Reese? Madam Chair? So I think that's a great question. The priority study list is developed. There's about 235 sites on the list. At our current discretionary funding level that MnDOT sets, we can fund about 2 noise walls a year with that money, so much longer than a 20-year waiting list, potentially. Also, there are some criteria that need to be met to be on the list and for any noise wall to be built under the MnDOT policy, either under this priority list standalone program or under the federal program, which is what this 494 project was done under. Under neither program would walls be eligible that don't meet the noise reduction and cost effectiveness criteria.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is for the MnDOT test floor. So I'm just trying to take a look at the map and figure out where the berm is. Is the berm located where you have possible ponding dry, trying to figure out the filtration ponding and that area, or where exactly is the berm? And then my follow-up question, and maybe I know the answer to this, but I'm just wondering, I'm hearing about the berm, and the berm is impeding a noise reduction wall. Can the berm be moved at all, or what's the purpose of the berm, I guess?
Please. Madam Chair, so the question is where is the location of the berm? It's a little tough to tell on this map, but the blue zigzag line is where we modeled the noise wall. The kind of faded green dotted line is where MnDOT right-of-way is. And then behind that, you can kind of see some vegetation along there. So that is where the berm is located, and it's actually on the private property. And so I think the question to whether the berm can be raised is not really a MnDOT question, because that is not our property. So in order to put new infrastructure like a wall or increase the height of the berm, MnDOT would need to own that property.
Okay. So Representative Anderson.
Yeah, if I could add to that. I mean, if you're looking at the map, the berm runs about from L8 to L10, and then the rest does not have the berm. So, and Madam Chair, I'll wait for any other comments until people are done with questions.
Are there other comments? Representative Joaquin?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe this is to Ms. Reese. I know there's a lot of physics that go behind noise walls, because I know once the noise gets it, it can bounce up and then further into a neighborhood. So when you talk about the cost effectiveness and the noise reduction equal, because we want to make sure we're spending money accurately when you can only build 2 walls a year. That's very sad. Could you maybe elaborate on that a little bit more about why the wall might not meet the standards for the noise effectiveness?
Ms. Reese?
Sure. Madam Chair, committee member. So the noise that is bouncing back from the new infrastructure that was built, studies have shown that reflection does happen, but in areas where there's a large expanse, it actually the noticeable increases in noise are quite minimal, usually about 1 to 2 decibels. That's because the noise, has to travel farther, has to come back across the roadway. It's also dispersed. It goes in other directions. And so really that increase is usually not measurable, except for cases where the roadway is very narrow. And I think the thing to keep in mind about the physics of the roadway is when we talk about how much a wall can actually reduce noise levels, that's kind of a set thing based on the roadway noise, the location of the homes, and the surrounding terrain, including the berm. It doesn't really matter what the noise levels are. So if noise is reflecting back, or if, the concrete difference of the project increased noise levels, the factor of how much a noise wall can really reduce noise is kind of a set thing. It doesn't get greater when the noise levels get greater.
Don't know if there's others who wish to testify. Kind of come to the conclusion, I think, of the... Did you, sir, wish to make another comment?
Yes, I would like to, please. I would like to point out that the wall that was studied by MnDOT runs this entire length of what you see on the map, about close to a mile long, I believe. And the cost effectiveness, if I recall, was based on the cost of the entire wall divided by the number of, I believe your term is benefited receptors, mm-hmm. which came out too high for the number of benefited receptors. Now, when we talk about modeling and a lot of variables and parameters that go into it, where are we measuring the receptor points? Most of these homes have backyards that face the freeway. If MnDOT considers the front of somebody's driveway, where they drive their car before they go in their house to sit in their backyard, they consider the front of that house as the receptor point. We're not looking at this correctly. I believe it can be looked at differently and yield a different result. I believe if we look at the townhouses on the north end of this, which is the right side of your map, several of these have windows that look directly onto the freeway, at grade of the freeway, that there is no doubt in my mind a shorter wall would have a more favorable cost per benefited receptor calculation. It all depends how you slice it and dice it. You could build a wall that meets the MnDOT parameters if you look at the right section. And I'm asking for a reevaluation of this so that each segment along the way is evaluated fairly. Lumping it all together for a mile-long stretch and then dividing it out by the cost of a mile-long wall versus what could be done by a half-mile wall or whatever, or measuring your receptors at a different location, can certainly yield a different result. It's all about how the model is run and how it's looked at. And I believe if we had had the opportunity, if we had been notified early on in the process, as we would have been today, we would have had the opportunity to look at this through every step of the process and not have to come back 2 years post-construction. So this is all I'm asking for.
Ms. Reese?
Madam Chair, just a response to that. So just a couple of points of clarification. There were two criteria that were not met when this wall was looked at. So the study was done, and the noise reduction effectiveness goal was not met. So even for those townhomes at the end where the wall was modeled, they were not able to achieve that 7 decibel noise reduction goal. So that was one reason. But also many of the homes along the single-family homes, they were getting only 2 to 4 decibels of additional noise reduction. So those homes were not able to be counted as benefited receptors. So there's kind of two impediments that cause the noise wall to not work. Also, I do believe that the receptors here are placed in the appropriate locations. They are faced, they're in the backyards of the houses facing the roadway, closest to the roadway. The receptors are placed so they're representing multiple homes, but we really tried to look at where people use their backyards. We're not placing them behind the homes or in the front yards or anything like this when we do the noise modeling.
Very good. Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, closing comment.
Yeah, let's see. I think we do have one more comment. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd mentioned before, I just wanted a quick follow-up. And I think it's important that we all collectively look at this as a quality of life issue for people in Minnesota. And knowing that we have it's not a 20-year waiting list, because if there's 235 sites that need this mitigation and there's only 2 happening a year,
it really demonstrates to me the need for more funding for our transportation department. And what when we cut corners on quality of life for people, it really impacts people's everyday life. And so I would like to see us band together and actually try to come up with the necessary funding so that we can get all these people off this list and improve the quality of life of Minnesotans along these highways and interstates.
So thank you, Representative Anderson, for bringing the bill. I think we've learned a lot more about noise barriers than still perhaps have a lot of questions. But do you want to have a final comment?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I know you guys are looking to wrap up here, so I want to be respectful of your time. I will tell you that Ms. Reese has been very responsive to this issue. We've been emailing each other for quite some time. MnDOT has had several meetings with me and with the neighborhood group. Rogers, just the elected representative of the entire neighborhood. And I will tell you, I have door-knocked this area myself many, many times, and it's a situation where an individual comes to the door, and I'm trying to tell them, hey, I'm your state representative. Do you have any questions for me? And it's kind of that white noise that you have in the background, and they can see your mouth is moving, but they can't hear the words coming out of your mouth. That's kind of the noise level that we're talking about here. And I will say, in the different conversations that I've had with many different MnDOT personnel on this issue, is in this area in particular, when they use the original noise analysis of this area, it is different now. And if they were using their current standard, this area would have qualified for the noise law. And so that's kind of the problem, especially for this neighborhood, is they were basically a year away from the new standards that would have actually made them qualify for this noise wall. And I think that that's kind of a problem in itself. I do appreciate the fact that the Department of Transportation is always looking to make sure that they're looking at their standards to see is this really the right method to use in testing these things. And I think it's good. But I do think that, you know, doing the analysis again, I think was helpful for the neighborhood to have a better understanding. I know that they've come out in other occasions to take a look at it, but we as the locals, we know what's going on. The last time that they tested it, all the kids were out of school. It was one of the breaks. And so you're not going to have as much traffic. You have a noticeable difference in the suburbs when kids don't have to go to school because parents take off and get out of town. So I do appreciate, again, I can't say this enough, I appreciate the department working with us on this issue, but I do think it would be important to have this analysis done again. And I just ask for your support.
So, Representative Anderson, I will bring you my motion to re-refer House File 2930 to the Transportation Finance Committee. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Thank and this meeting is adjourned right on time.
Good job. We'll be talking.